Stay home and chill, keeping you company during the coronavirus.
Yo, this is Michael Payne, and I host the Michael and Marcel Show on FUBAR Radio every Wednesday from 4 till 6 p.m. Thanks for staying at home. The only thing we want you to catch is a vibe. You're listening to Stay Home and Chill on FUBAR Radio, keeping you company through the coronavirus.
Michael Payne and Marcel Somerville on FUBAR Radio.
Our guest goes by the name Scroobius Pip, ladies and gentlemen.
How's it going?
Music, that's how you kind of got onto people's radar. That was your foot in the door, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Juggling many balls, spinning many, many plates. Successful as well.
It's a weird one. I always say it all depends on when people board the train as such. Because I was doing like street art and making short films and photography before I was doing music. But the music was the one that seemed to get everyone's attention. Yeah. So now anything else I do, no matter how exciting or big, the first comment will always be, is there any new music on the way? Man, we worked on this film for a year, but have you got any new tracks?
Yeah. No. Even if slightly infuriating, it must be quite flattering as well.
It's all great. It's that thing of, as said, I mean, speaking of long names, the reason I took the name Scroobius Pip was because it's from this poem thing, and it's about a creature that, a long story short, it decides it can be many different things. It is its own thing. It doesn't have to go under one label.
Yeah.
So that's why I took that name, because I was doing some spraying, some rapping, some spoken words, some films. So I was like, all right, I was thinking at that point, I need to decide which one I am. Am I a rapper? Right. Am I a spoken word artist? Am I an actor? Mm. Am I a writer? And I decided I'm just a Scroobius Pip. But that was always clear in my head. It wasn't clear in everyone else's head.
Right.
So I've not seen this transition into podcasting or into acting as some big change. Mm. So, well, I've always just tried to do interesting shit.
But yeah, I guess people can only see the timeline as it's happening, innit?
Yeah.
Once you're on their radar, you're right, they will take it at face value. And also be quite selfish, innit? It's however people first heard of you, that's what they will associate you with.
You've got to accept that, though, right? If you're putting, because essentially, the first time you release anything, you're making yourself a product.
Yeah.
As ugly and gross as it might feel, that's what you're doing.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The customer's always right isn't incredibly accurate, but there's an element of it.
In this day and age, I wonder if managers still say that to their staff.
Again, just going over all my jobs and that. I worked in HMV and I got to like junior management type status, and I begged my staff to come to me if someone was being angry
or
wanted a refund, because I love just killing them with kindness. Just being like, oh, I'm really sorry, I can't do anything. And they'll get furious and then they'll customer service, and customer service knew me by name because they were like, it's Pip again, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And then customer service would clear it, and I'd love going out because the customer ready to throw it in my face, and I'd be, I was so pleased that we could sort that out for you. And they'd be like, just getting angry and angry. I love it.
No, I hear
it. Makes
that
work interesting.
No, I hear
just
that.
Killing them with kindness in that way. I'd make a sport of it. I'd be like, I'm going to annoy them so much with a smile on my face, go so they can't actually get me done for anything.
Yeah.
Be super polite, push them to the edge, and then not give them that relief of they've won. Go, I'm so pleased you've won. What? Nah, this doesn't feel good. I don't care. It's not my
That's
company.
That's definitely a takeaway from today's show, isn't it? Like, if you're ever pissed off at work, follow those rules. Mate.
Yeah, just make a game of it, man. End of the day, it's your job, but it's not your company. It's weird that it comes into why I started doing podcasting, because I was working on XFM at the time. And again, I sat down on a little break from doing my radio show, and I sat down with Joe Rogan on his podcast, and he kind of said to me, he's like, so why are you doing it for someone else, though? And I was like, well, it's XFM, it's commercial radio, it's this big thing. He's like, are there restrictions? I'm like, yeah. So why are you doing it for someone else? I think that translates into so many jobs. I remember, again, in my HMV days, I'd do so many extra hours unpaid as management. It's my store. I need to get this done. It's like, why are you doing that? Put those hours in for yourself, for what you want to do, for achieving your dreams. Mm. But why are you putting them in for someone else who's got millions and isn't kind of giving you a slice?
Wickedest thing is, like, the title itself would make you even more angry. Why am I doing it for a company called His Master's Voice?
Yeah, man.
Fuck that shit.
I've still got mad love for HMV, but when I was leaving there, there was this situation where, because of the time I'd given in my notice, I couldn't get a bonus or whatever it was. And they put in writing, the reason is a lot of people check out after they handed their notice. And I could send them footage, which I've still got, I shouldn't have taken, but of CCTV. I was working in a rough HMV of these four lads robbing the store. No one doing anything other than me grabbing them, then getting my face smashed in, literally.
Oh,
three of them landing punches and flooring me. I never hit the floor. That's why I kept the video. Because I was proud of that. I
clearly that will lost. Never be found.
I clearly lost, but I didn't hit the floor. And I kind of sent them that. I was like, mate, that was in my notice period.
That was last week.
You're telling me I weren't dedicated. I might not have been dedicated. I'm getting beaten up for you.
For real.
Even though I'm leaving. And I don't know where I'm going with any of this. That was some good times. They lumped me and I ran after them. And as I got out the front, they were all piling in a car, kind of going, come on. And I was like, that's the moment it hit. I was like, what am I doing? No, you're all right. You help yourselves. I ain't jumping in a car with three random hoodlums.
Come on, then.
I'm going to take you down, hanging off the bonnet and shit. And I was like, yeah, all right, enjoy your iPods.
Ian Boltzmann on Free Bar Radio.
So we're here today with Dave Benson Phillips. The book we were talking about, One of Us is Lying, there's a book which explores very much in that book the ideas of being internet famous and the ideas of how sort of tenuous that is and also how tentative that is. It could fall away at any point for a wrong tweet.
Yeah.
And I find that, and also, what's his face, Ronson's book as well, he did the
John
You've Been Shamed.
Yes.
Which was all about that, about people who... And regular Joes, by the way, not people that were in the entertainment industry, who had just tweeted the wrong thing at the wrong time, that had gone viral and destroyed their lives and they'd lost their jobs and all that sort of thing. And I think it's quite... I find that really interesting. Because that they're but the grace, but for the grace of God, go any of us who've got social media. Like, any of us.
Yeah.
You know, you could be tired. You could be... Do you know what? You don't even have to be tired. You could be like, this is funny.
Or you
could do as I did, wake up one morning and find that nobody's booking you because everybody thinks you're dead.
Which is horrific.
So I didn't
know about this until Ian mentioned it
earlier.
How did that even come about?
Well, do you know what? We still to this day don't know.
Right.
You'll never trace that.
Well, the only way that Mrs. Phillips and I have looked at it in the past was that there was a spate of sort of celebrity hoaxed deaths.
Which still happens,
but now people now research things. And there's things in place. Whereas back in those days, I get the oddest feeling that people, if they saw it online, like as they used to do in the papers, if it's printed in the papers, it must be true.
Sure, yeah.
And in our particular case, I think that's what happened. It was online, a load of celebrity-related deaths, and thankfully a lot of the celebrities who were involved or who were called out for this thing, they were able to say, no, that's not true. Listen to my voice, here we are. And yeah, I was on the road at the time, performing and doing various things.
Was this pre-Twitter? It was before that it came out?
Do you know what? It's all around the same time. It was Facebook, it was Twitter, all that sort of thing.
So I'm wondering if someone, because it comes about a lot at the moment on Twitter, somebody tweets something and then suddenly it spreads.
Well, sometimes it's, oh, is that for me? Oh, thank you very much. I've just had my microphone adjusted. Apparently I wasn't projecting.
I'm trying to do the levels.
Well,
normally I give it sort of my full set of beans, but you're quite quiet. You're so quiet.
And I'm not quiet.
Well, no, but what I'm talking about sort of voice-wise, it's not like there's some stations I've been into and you have to boom and enunciate and be very...
Yeah, you find the level of the room, eh? You find that, that's true. Okay.
So getting back to what I'm saying, so that's what's kind of happened in our case. I mean, for instance, just to give an idea, my very good friend and geezer, Neil Buchanan.
Oh, I love, just mentioned
who,
him, I love
who
him.
Who used to present Art Attack.
Yep.
Now, the way they reported his death online was they said that Neil Buchanan of Art Attack died of a heart attack.
Oh.
So the thing was, the subtlety was in the joke. Mm. But of course, when you're reading it, you go, oh no, not him.
Yeah.
And then you go and look into
and that
it.
Went properly
that
everywhere.
That went properly viral.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
In my case, when you get things like that happening, mine was that I was killed in a car crash on the way to a gig in Torquay.
Right.
Okay, where's the humour in that?
Mm. It's not a great one, is it?
No.
I suppose Torquay is kind of intrinsically funny, but that's not...
No,
it's a prick's trick, isn't it, really, at the end of the day? Mm. It's someone being a dick on the internet.
Well, the thing is, we actually still don't know to this day, sir, who actually did it. And the awful thing is, as much as we've actually done loads to claw my life back, which is what I've been doing, but we were still affected to it. To a certain degree.
Did you do a show about it?
Yeah, I did.
I did it at the
Brighton Fringe. And we'd always joked about me standing up and doing a show and talking about what had happened.
Yeah.
And it was called, please, if I can say it, Dave Benson Phillips. Christ, I thought he was dead.
Nice.
And we got to talk about it. And it was really quite interesting because there was a Q&A section. And I thought people would be asking me about all the weird things that have been happening to me since the time of my death and me having to sort of work and try and work. And then, I was just telling my friend and good scriptwriter, who's the guy who wrote this, Andrew River, who's out actually in the next room.
Okay.
And I was
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
He's waiting. in there. But I was just telling them about the fact that I've only just been allowed to get a passport back.
Really?
Yeah, because it was invalidated.
Joey Page on FUBAR Radio.
It's time to welcome Keith from We Are Scientists. Hello, Keith. How are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm really, really excited to have you on my show. Been a fan of you guys since you started out. Six albums in is no mean feat by any stretch of the imagination. So what I wanted to ask you was, obviously you've been very consistent bringing out albums and stuff, but do you find it has gotten easier or harder? Like, do you get any kind of writer's block? Do you find it actually comes a lot easier as you've got down the line?
I think it does come easier. I mean, I have the sense that, at least with me, writer's block has always been a purely psychological ailment. I think the more you do it and the less you really are concerned about whether or not songwriting will happen, it's pretty easy to get past any real sense of writer's block. I think early on, when we had only written one or two records, and in some senses it could have been a fluke, there is a bit of that terror where you think, uh-oh, can I possibly replicate the feat of writing 10 songs that I'd want to put on a record? By six songs, you really stop worrying about whether or not that was incidental.
When I listened to them, I was like, oh, I wish I could hang out with those guys. They seem really fun, as opposed to like another sort of try.
Yeah, I mean, our sensibility has kind of always been that we want people that are interested in our music to feel like they know us and to come to our shows because it seems like we're all hanging out. I think it probably does do us a bit of disservice to not try to cultivate the sense that some bands do of mystery and a supernatural air to their gifts. In some ways, that probably does help maintain people's deep affection and reverence for them, but I think we just always tend to have more fun when people kind of get who we are and are there because they feel like they're in on it.
Hugh Joseph on FUBAR Radio.
If you have been living under a rock, then you wouldn't have heard of Deadpool. It's huge. It's massive. We're very, very proud of our very own Ed Skrein. He plays Ajax, Francis Freeman, the supervillain in the movie. He's joining us from the States right now. Ed Skrein.
How you doing, fellas? You all right?
Oh, we're doing good, mate. You're on such a good run of Game of Thrones, Transporter. I also saw a quote from Transporter saying, "The shadow of Jason Statham loomed large over this reboot, but Ed Skrein nails it." And now Deadpool. This is incredible. Deadpool, in his first 4 days, has already grown so much that it's one of the biggest superhero movies of all time. How are you feeling, dude? How are you feeling about all this?
I mean, all that stuff is just a bonus to a project that I'm fucking proud of. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I love the people that we made it with. When we were making it, it didn't feel like we were making some big studio movie. It felt like it was a very small bunch of cast and your first time director with underdogs, and everyone had something to prove. You know, you got Ryan Reynolds, who obviously he's an A-lister compared to like most of us, but he had something to prove after Green Lantern and all that. And then you got, you know, Gina Carano's an MMA fighter, you got little old me, you got Brianna doing her first movie, Leslie Uggams plays Brian Dow. She used to sing with Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra, have her own variety show, but people don't know who she is now. And it's a project that I love doing and that I was super proud of. And to be honest, even if it bombed, I would have still been proud of it, you know what I'm saying? So it's a real bonus that actually the good guys can win. And a project that was done with integrity and done with heart and passion and treated like a school project, you know, it was pure love and heart. And you know that you can still win when you do things like that, and you don't have to go and do some bullshit and sell your soul, because I'm not in it for that. You know what I mean? I'll go get a normal job. I'm not here for that. This is why I love Tim Miller, my director. When we Skyped the first time, he said the C word about 10 times in our Skype conversation. I was like, man, he's a man after my own heart. And the whole movie, we were trying to find the right place for me to drop it in a Marvel movie, but it always felt gratuitous. And we tried a couple of places, like at the end when I'm laughing at him and I say, "You silly effing idiot."
Yeah.
We were going to say, "You silly effing C," but it just never felt right. And so we didn't put it in because we don't put things in just for the sake of it. Bless him, you know what I mean? He's really trying to get the C word in a Marvel movie.
I love that.
Why it works so well is because it's not some hammy old shit that we've seen before. It's not these larger than life characters. It's human, man. This is about a messed up dude who fell in love, who didn't want to drag his girl into down with him, and then hit rock bottom, and then got messed up by a horrible C word, and then me, and then wanted to get revenge so that he could get his pretty Ryan Reynolds look back, so that he could get back with his girl. And ultimately, when you watch the movie, it is just that. Relatable, it's a human thing. I'm really proud of what everybody did, you know. It's the sum of its parts, and I take very little credit for my part because Tim Miller is such an incredible director, you know.
Oh, really... yeah, come on! Come on, Ed, come on.
Access all areas on FUBAR Radio.
We've got our guest, the very lovely, very talented Britain's Got Talent, Robert White. Hello.
Well, more than contestant, I came second in.
Okay, well, you can.
I have to say,
runner up to the winner.
In my eyes, should have been the winner.
Oh well, you know, your eyes don't vote that much on the phone.
I know. I did try. I did try.
Maybe I have to admit, time. I never vote in anything other than Eurovision.
All right,
so,
all right, well, don't tell the Brexiteers that. Next time you want to vote, use your finger, not your eyes.
Can I say?
The keypad on the phone will be much more successful. Dude, I was looking at the phone so much with my eyes.
I was willing
you to win.
Yes.
Now, congratulations, though. You did very well coming second. I know you wanted to win it, and I wanted you to win it.
What's money apart from money?
Well, exactly. Okay, it doesn't matter. Money doesn't matter.
No,
but it does.
So it does. Well, it did. You did extremely well.
Right.
I mean, how was the whole experience for you?
It was crazy. It was exciting. It was spectacular. I've had very odd experiences since. I've had lots of people come up to me and say that they supported me. A few have said they've supported me by just staring at the phone rather than actually picking the thing up. But support is still support, and I've got lots of stuff out of it. And I've got lots of people who say that I mean a lot to them because of Asperger's, or I mean a lot to them because I'm gay, or I mean a lot to them because I'm their son. Hello, mum.
Wait, crazy clothing that I adore.
Haven't got a tank top on today.
No, that was your thing, right? You wore tank tops.
Well, tank tops is my... Well, I'm on radio. I have got a tank top on today.
It's lies. You're lying to us.
Well, who cares? It's reality TV. It's all lies.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So, yes, it's an amazing... The programme, it's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it is amazing. The judges are all very different. Was Simon Cowell kind to you? Did you enjoy the experience, or did you think at times they were a bit harsh and didn't quite get you?
I think they all got me. I thought they thought I was funny. I think Simon's got a slight withering stare. Which
he's not one for a laughing unless he really does find it funny.
Well,
right?
He can boil your heart from a distance. That's all I can say. But I think he's lovely. He's lovely. You know, it's only his exterior which is slightly, you know, gruff. But don't blame him for that. Blame the surgeons. I would say that...
Yes.
I did not say that. No, I did not say that. And, no, they're all lovely. And David's lovely, and Alicia's lovely, and the other one, can't remember her name.
Amanda.
They're all
acceptable. They all do their job.
They're all lovely. We spoke to them afterwards. We, you know, met up for a few dinners and group chats and stuff like that. Eventually, I had to, you know, ask them to leave because it was getting a bit boring. But... you know, they just wanted to come round all the time.
I know, I can imagine. They always come as a person.
Using my coffee, taking my milk.
And sugar, how dare they?
Staring at my phone, not actually using it, just staring at the
pretending
phone.
Pretending to vote.
You've really caused some upset here, Lizzie.
Sorry, but I did actually vote. I'll let you know.
I don't believe you.
I did, because my boys are very into, not to the X Factor, but they love they love Britain's Got Talent. And I think, I mean, why do you think the show is such a hit? Because do you think it is the chemistry between the judges, or everyone loves the
feel
acts
good,
and the feel good and that?
Well, there's such a sort of like big mix of different talent. It's a crazy Saturday night thing, and it's got some really... Well, seriously, the judges are great and they know what they're doing. And where they produce it, and they get like some acts who are sort of really amateur and don't know what they're doing, and then they've got some acts who are sort of polished. It's sort of like watching a crazy jumble sale sort of Primark talent show type thing, like sort of like just smashed in front of your face on a Saturday evening, isn't it?
It's God,
just,
yes. Like, do you know I think you're right.
And, you know, everyone likes to be entertained.
Yes, that's true. And whether they're good or bad. Luckily, you were good.
Well, touch
but
then
it's good
actually,
old-fashioned
to
fun.
Open with, if I remember your audition right, to open with, they kind of played it like, oh God, what's he going to do?
Well, the thing is that because I have got Asperger's and I do have issues connecting with people, ever since I've started comedy, I've always had a thing of having to get over the fact my first impression to people is slightly awkward. Mm-hmm. And if I'm in a radio studio and people are nice and smiling, it's one thing. But if I'm in a rough pub comedy night where you get apples and bottles and bananas thrown at you, if you come across as slightly awkward for your first gambit, then it doesn't always pay off well. So I developed a way of turning that into a positive.
Mm-hmm.
So they were basically portraying on screen what I do anyway.
Got it.
But it sort of went with the whole Britain's Got Talent. Who is he? Isn't he?
Yeah.
Because
what's going on?
Sometimes they like to do that. that, don't they?
I think that's kind of their modus operandi, isn't
yeah.
it?
It's true. It's
like they like to play on how people yes. how people work.
But you've done so much for that, because there's a lot of people that are listening who do suffer with it and you know, trying to cope and deal with it everyday life, and you've done so incredibly well.
I think the thing is that, as you say, suffer, people do say suffer with it, but it's more like, it's like having it.
Yeah.
And I think
living with it.
Well, just having it, you know, okay. it, because you can show that, you know, someone who's got this is like on TV and making people laugh and is going through this and doing that and having people support them by staring at the phone. And all these
I didn't stare! Right. I did.
You did.
My son phoned, I stared.
Instead of, like, you know, all autistic people are like Rain Man, or all autistic people are chewing computers or whatever. You know, this is someone who's got a level of sort of social competence, and he's got people who friends around him and stuff like that. It's sort of trying to, in the same yeah. way as, you know, 500 years ago, someone who looked like a left-handed person and go, isn't that person odd? Now, true. You know, society's going, there's all sorts of, you know,
yeah.
you know, whether you're a woman...
Right or left-handed.
Right
who,
or left-handed.
I mean, who,
yes.
who cares?
Now...
It doesn't matter.
You can get your own pens.
Now you don't have to be burnt as a witch.
I would have definitely been.
If you are a witch, there's lots of opportunities for you, like, you know, writing for...
Britain's Got Talent.
Well, writing for tabloid magazines or... or political office.
Well, I'm hoping to achieve both in my career, well, so I'm halfway there.
Well, the car is a broom.
I wouldn't say writing for tabloid magazine is an achievement, but it's something you could do.
Well, it's a way to pass the time.
Yeah, it is indeed.
Very absorbent.
Dan Clark on Fubar Radio.
Our guest today, Roger Michelle. Thank you for coming in, Roger.
My pleasure. Just my neighbourhood radio station. Cool. I live about half a mile away. On my way home.
Yeah. Which is why you agreed to do it.
Well,
I can't walk
enthusiasm.
Past having yeah. said no.
Exactly.
I might have to keep detouring every day yeah. out of guilt. You were just saying, while the song was playing, that you actually shot the video for this
yes,
song.
Yes, I did. Yeah, we went to Bromley, which is where both Hanif Qureshi, who wrote The Buddha of Suburbia, yeah. and David Bowie were raised, both Bromley boys. And like a lot of people who came out of Bromley, they kind of came out of Bromley and went, wah! Yeah. You know, I'm going to do anything not to be kind of digested by the suburbs.
Yeah.
And we went to shoot this little thing, and we found this perfect little sort of almost a parody of a suburban street in the middle of Bromley. It was in the autumn. There was no one around. We shot for a day in and around the streets where Hanif and David were brought up. Halfway through the day, this old bloke sort of came up and muttered to me, said, oh, I've just been to see his mum around the corner. David Bowie's mum.
Well, here's the connection. I'm from Bromley.
You're from Bromley.
I was born and bred in Beckenham. That's partly why I was such a big fan of the series. Also, because it was such a brilliant series. But I actually watched this, The Bitter of Suburbia, maybe 3 or 4 years after it had gone
yeah,
out.
Yeah, you must be too young to have watched
it. I think
it was
14 or 15 when yeah. it actually broadcast. So yeah. I was about maybe 17, 18 when I watched it. And this was before the expression binged watched,
yes.
which we all know
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
But me and my friend Ollie Mortman, who was also from that kind of part of the world, we sat and watched it on VHS all in one sitting until like 3 a.m.
Great.
And then I watched it about 7 years ago, so like 15 years later, and I couldn't believe how well it still held up.
Oh, good. I haven't seen it for ages and ages.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear it. You think it still stands up.
Absolutely, and it's sort of so of its own, the kind of the tone of it and the performances and the feel. There's not an awful lot of other things that feel like that show.
It's a very special period, isn't it? It
yeah.
ends, if you remember, it ends the day Margaret Thatcher is elected. So
right.
it ends in 1979. Kareem, who's the leading character,
mm-hmm.
and Hanif and I think are all the same age. We had the same records. We had the same terrible clothes. We had the same interest in obscure books at a very early age. And then, as you know, in the second half of the book, he travels from Bromley to the world of the theatre,
yeah.
Particularly the Royal Court Theatre, which is, again, exactly what Hanif and I both did. And, in fact, we both met at the Royal Court in the late 70s
okay.
when he was an usher and I was an assistant director. I was assisting people like Samuel Beckett and John Osborne. And Hanif was a fledgling writer and usher and part of the Young Writers Company there. And so a lot of the people who occur in the second half of the series are very ill-disguised people who we knew
yeah.
and who got very grumpy to see how they were being portrayed.
I was going to ask how come you've worked with Hanif so many times over your career, but that's obviously...
That's how we kicked
off. The main
off.
Reason yeah. you had such an immediate sort of connection over those similarities.
Yes,
right?
We adapted the scripts together. So we were locked in a room in the BBC
yeah.
a sort of tiny little office with a lino and one desk. And we were just sort of locked in there for a month, turning out these scripts really, really quickly, sort of emergency.
I was a bit too young to know how it did in terms of like how it was received and viewing figures and things like that. Was it a big show at the time?
It was a big splash. It won lots of gongs, but it also, it made it onto the front page of The Sun, episode 3, because it was full of nudity and sex and bad behaviour in the suburbs.
Yeah,
yeah. They did a big splash saying how disgraceful it was.
And you were like, yes.
Get in. Come on.
Yeah.
That was really terrific. It's interesting because it's a period piece. You know, when we made it in 91, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it was already about an era that had passed by. And I remember making the film and everyone saying, I won't get much extra money because it's like now, isn't it?
Yeah.
And of course, it wasn't like now at all. It was pre-trainers.
Mm-hmm.
It was pre-satellite dishes.
Right.
Whenever you did an exterior shot, you had to replace every single car. So you might as well have been doing Jane Austen. You know, which in fact was the next thing I did do. It's just the same as making a Jane Austen period film. Everything, every stitch of clothing, everything had to be replaced in the landscape.
I often think about that when people do period stuff and you're like, is it the script supervisor? Who is it that's like looking at all the different windows in the background? Yeah. And, you know, just even like how new or old, if you're doing a period thing of 20 years ago, was the paint crumbling back then?
Good. Of course it wasn't. I mean, lots of these period films are set in sort of glorious country houses which are crumbling and decaying, and that's part of our sensibility. We like that as a generation. We find that attractive Rustic. And compelling. Whereas, of course, at the time, they would have been crisp and clean and beautifully kept.
It was so groundbreaking at the time. Yeah. Were you immediately, like, with Hannah, should we go and make some more movies together, or did that just happen?
That just happened. Actually, years passed. I went off and made a period film. As you can probably see from my CV, whenever I make one type of film, the next thing I'd like to be as different as possible. So it wasn't until The Mother, which was probably 10 years later, maybe even more,
maybe
actually.
More.
Yeah, yeah, maybe 20 years later, that we reconvened. And then since then, we've made 3 or 4 films.
You made a few quite close together in that period as well, The Mother and Venus.
Yeah, Mother and Venus, and then there was a bit of a gap, and then we did a film called Le Weekend.
Which is great, yeah. Is there something when you work together where it's like having worked with other writers in between and then you're back here and you go, oh.
We're quite grumpy with each other. We're a bit like a couple in Le Weekend in that we sort of bicker and struggle and fight and are friends. It's not an easy process. So it takes a long time for us to get to a point where we actually want to make the film, make you know, the materials ready to go to the next stage.
Mark Dolan on FUBAR Radio.
Tori Amos, 8-time Grammy Award-winning nominated American singer-songwriter, pianist, composer, classically trained musician with a mezzo-soprano vocal range. He's on FUBAR Radio with us now. Hi, Tori.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Oh, I'm so well. I'm thrilled to have you. I'm giddy with excitement. I'm such a big fan. And I'm thrilled to notice and hear that you're actually in London. So you're on the very same soil as ourselves, because we're in Islington in North London.
Yes, Mark. I'm not far.
How have you found Britain? Do you like Britain? I know you've performed here on many occasions. How do you find British crowds?
Oh, I love the Brits.
Yeah?
Because they're fun. They're cheeky. I adore them. And they have a good sense of humor, which is, of course, you know that. So they keep me laughing.
I'm so glad to hear it. Now, I'd love to talk to you about your relationship with the piano, because you're such an amazing piano player as well as singer and songwriter. And, you know, has your love for the piano ever dimmed? Have you ever felt sort of constricted behind this great device and felt the need to just throw it away? And because, you know, in most senses, musically, you do reinvent yourself all the time and you never repeat. There's no evidence of you really repeating yourself. But tell me about your relationship with that instrument.
Well, since I was 2.5, I was playing it, and I realized this was a friend. It's my first language. I'd say to you that I trust it, really trust it, more than I almost trust anything in the world. And I go to it to understand what I'm feeling and thinking. So it's a dear friend, and it's never let me down or betrayed me. So I'm very loyal to it, and I've been trying to find different collaborators, so how it works with guitars, how it works with strings, how it works with drums. And those collaborations have been really inspiring, and then take me to another way of making music.
One of the reasons why I'm such a fan of your work is because I love the piano so much, and I love how versatile the piano is. Obviously a classical instrument, clearly, but also it's such a great rock instrument, and the way that you play the piano and the rhythm with which you play the piano is so engaging. And you know, it's a very versatile instrument, in some ways underexploited, but that's what's given you such a kind of unique selling point all these years, because it's not commonplace to see a female artist sat behind a piano and singing. It's still quite a rare thing somehow.
I was fascinated in developing a performance style with it quite a long time ago, because I looked to the guitar players and I saw that they were tapping into this unbelievable energy. Almost, I've termed it a 220 voltage type of energy. Mm. And, you know, Prince, Jimi Hendrix, a lot of the great rock guitar players. And I thought to myself a long time ago that this energy is something that I can access and I want to tap into and collaborate with the piano on it. So I would bring a keyboard to my other side and play keyboards, one with my left and one with my right hand, and straddle the piano stool almost as if it's a stallion. Mm-hmm. So that was how I was able to really whip that energy up and get the keyboards talking back and forth to each other. Because you play differently. You see, if you're in the upper register with your left hand mark, and you're with your right hand, if you're in a different register, then the sound that you're creating is very, very different, because you play the left hand. There are certain patterns you make as a left hand bass piano player. So when I am playing way up in the mids in the upper range of the piano with my left hand, and in my right hand playing it lower, then people are beginning to hear a combination they're not used to. So it's those kinds of discoveries that I was making over the years.
And obviously influence, I suppose, because clearly all artists will listen to others, get inspired and think, oh, well, maybe I can have, you know, do my take on that. And we in the past, have you enjoyed the output of, you know, Leon Russell, let's say, Elton John, people like that, who have very much turned the piano into a rock instrument before you hit the scene?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Great piano players, great. And Billy Joel. Mm. Great piano players, all that you've mentioned. And I do believe that you get inspired, I get inspired, by listening to all kinds of styles, how people utilize the instrument. And you begin to realize that there are certain things that you're able to achieve easier than others. Some people can do a real ragtime playing or more rock and roll playing. Others have more of a jazz lean. Mm. And others have a classical lean. So each person, each player can uniquely develop their style. That isn't like anybody else's. And that's always exciting to hear any piano player play.
How do you write?
It's different. I either have an experience or I'm listening to stories from people all over the world. They tell me stories that then triggers a memory, or I have a similar experience that happens to me after that story. How the muses work, it's not just a similar pattern. I can't just wake up and start writing songs. It doesn't work like that for me.
No, Tori, some people seem to decide that there's a time of year when they're going to go and record an album. They book the studio and they just, that's like July of next year, and they get in the studio and they just start writing, and it's a very pressurized process. But your process a bit more organic than that. Do you pretty much have the songs ready before you go into the studio?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I'd say if you're talking about my whole career, there might have been times in the very early days when they needed a B-side and I'd have to come up with something, and that might have been a cover. We're talking 91. We're talking way back when, 1991, 92.
Right.
But when I make records, I go in with the songs, because that way I know where we're going. I know the direction. And sometimes you have to take pilgrimages. You travel to have experiences and to shake up the routine. I find that when you shake up the routine and you're exposing yourself to different places,
yeah,
then you think differently. You think in a different rhythm, different melody, different influences come in and surround you. And so sometimes you have to push yourself as a writer, put yourself in different places around the world to get new inspiration in order to stay fresh.
Michael Payne and Marcel Somerville on FUBAR Radio.
We've got an R&B legend in the house right now. Someone who I used to put your songs on mixtapes. You got me a lot of sex, basically.
Yeah.
You got me a lot of
that's
sex in the past, you know what I mean? It's an absolute honour to have
it,
you
man.
Come through.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
So
for
I'll just introduce you as the fucking king of R&B for me, Donald Jones, man.
What are you saying?
You know?
Appreciate it.
Lots of comments floating around about who the king of R&B is. I'm sure you're aware of that. But yeah, like I said, no one kind of I hold in as high esteem as you when it comes to slow jams, R&B. I've got my mate outside who I speak to quite often. He's like a brother to me. And he will know how much we appreciate your music, man.
Man, so I appreciate that, man. I mean, you know, there's so many kings in this R&B thing. You know, you got to take your hat off to people like Joe.
That era, Genuine, Joe, John B, obviously.
Yeah, man, John B, man, Genuine. It's just so many great artists that has come.
Mm. Yeah, what do you think's changed? For me, like, there were so many greats back then, both R&B groups and solo R&B stars. And
I don't think there's many like that individuals anymore. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, I think the message in the music has changed.
This is a good point because you are all about love, which is why you're a perfect guest.
Love,
to have just before
relationships, makeups, breakups. I mean, love ain't going nowhere. That's universal. That's God.
Yeah.
We can all get sex and all of that. You know, we can talk about that, but the love, the makeup, relationships, breakup. Those things, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the type of stuff I like to talk about.
Yeah, you got me a lot of love as well, by the way. I did say sex, but you know what I mean? Sex sells.
Oh, yeah. Sex sells, too.
Interesting fact I found out about one of your hits. It was the first number one on the Billboard charts of the 21st century.
Yeah, man. It was the first and the last. Last number one record, and they brought in the millennium. You know what's up?
That's the sixth.
So, I guess that's going to be one of those trivia questions or something
that
like that.
That will
you know?
Be, yeah. I'm sure that's been on quizzes. If it ever comes up in our pub quiz, then we'll know the answer now.
Yeah, that's a blessing, man. I'm glad that the universe seemed fit that I brought in the new millennium. Yeah.
You're also one of those artists that before coming out in your own right as an artist, you're a prolific writer as well.
Yes, yeah.
And you've written for like Usher, 702, which, you know, not as many people will know, not as many people as Usher's fans, you know, they won't have as many fans as Usher. But the writing that you were doing for other artists, was that before kind of breaking out on your own?
Yeah, that was actually before. I wrote on Usher's first album. I worked with Silk, 702. I worked with Brownstone. Work with a few artists, man. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
That was before I became an artist myself. That's how I got my big break.
Would you say that is your favorite aspect of being an artist, the writing itself? Because you've got such a knack for writing about love.
I would say writing and producing. That's my favorite thing. And then actually going on stage and being able to perform your own songs in front of a crowd and see how they react to it and participate with it. I mean, all three, you know, to be honest with you,
But production as well is another string that you
got. Oh, yeah, production, that's my love right there, you know. All of them, man. Anything that has to do with music, man, I love.
Are there plans for another release anytime soon?
I'm actually, man, I got the bug. I was fortunate enough to work on Jacquees' new album.
Sick.
I did a song on there called 23, and that kind of like gave me the bug to be like, okay, I'm ready to make another album.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of took a little bit break because me and my wife, we had a son. Stayed at home and watched my son grow, so he's now 3. So now I feel like, you know, it's time for me to get back out here and do what I got to do.
And how about your son? Do you like him to kind of carry on your legacy?
I want him to do whatever is in his heart.
Fair play.
Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Today, my very special guest is the wonderful Thomas Turgoose. Hello, Thomas.
Hello.
We were just talking while the song was on about TV series. The show you said you were really into is Entourage, right?
Yeah, because of the content of it, obviously, I'm right in thinking it's based on Matt Wahlberg's life when he was young.
Yeah, yeah. He's an exec, isn't he?
He's the exec, yeah. And he makes a few appearances in it. And it just makes me think, I want to go to America and smash America, just because of the amount of fun that they're having in it and just the characters as well, like Jeremy Piven, who plays Harry Gold.
Yeah.
There's just no TV character like him. It's unbelievable.
He's amazing, yeah.
So, yeah, I watched it back in, like, November.
I wouldn't, like, go over to America thinking your life is going to suddenly be exactly like those guys.
Yeah, it'd be like Vinny Chase, isn't it? Suddenly I get to America and I send it to Matt Wahlberg. It doesn't make me want to get my head screwed on. I just think, I want to do that well. It's kind of a good thing, I suppose.
Ian Boldsworth on FUBAR Radio.
We're joined now by journalist and documentary maker Ben Zand.
Hello.
Hello, so you're right. Oh, this is badly organised, isn't it? I can't even see you.
Oh, no, I can't see your face. I'll scoot. Oh, no.
Doesn't matter. Let's do it as if we're all just on the phone to each other.
I've been to FUBAR Studios twice now, and both times the first thing someone said was...
You can swear.
You can swear.
Don't have to.
I don't even like swearing. No, you actually, don't I do like swearing.
Don't seem like a swearer.
But anyway, what was the song you were going to sing at the end?
Oh, at the end? I'm not sure I'm going to sing a song.
What was the song? You brought it up.
Can You Stand the Rain?
Can we get a karaoke version of Can You Stand the Rain, please?
It's a really weird song to suggest, actually. No, it wasn't a hit at all. It was just a song I liked as a kid. I was an emotional child. I had a lot of feelings. Anyway.
Do you know what? We talk about this later on, though. Yeah. I was talking about... how old are you?
27.
Okay, I'm 24. But I was... my favourite song, my romantic song I played earlier on was Alone by Heart. Do you know that song?
I don't know.
Okay, that and REO Speedwagon. Can't Fight This Feeling Anymore. I've sang it already on the show. And what was the other one?
Eternal Flame by the Bangles.
I definitely. My mum used to have a friend called Vicky. She was very nice, nice Scouse lady, and she would always say to me, "Why should Why do you like such depressing songs?"
Right.
I'd be like, "They're not depressing. It's about love."
Yeah, they're inspiring.
Love is a good thing.
What about What about Jim Steinman music?
I actually don't even know what these things are.
Meatloaf, like all battered hell.
Oh, okay, okay. So I like Meatloaf. Yeah,
they would do anything. Get under your skin, those songs. From a romantic point of view.
Trying to think, what else did I like?
Broke me off.
So emotional that you broke your pen.
But to go
no, someone else's pen. It's not even mine.
Well, can we talk about some of your other documentaries?
Talk about everything.
Don't get onto that. Don't get onto everything in the world.
The ones that I saw that were out just before the R. Kelly one were the ones about you going into a cult, into Melanation, and with the mega churches. And so some of the pastors that you kind of met who have these mega churches. They're very interesting documentaries with some of the bizarre characters that were in there. I think one guy, I can remind me of his name, who had the massive carrots. And he said it was blessed by
Pastor
God
Sanchez.
In the village. Pastor Sanchez. What a guy.
And did you join this as a thing?
Yeah, no, so I'll give you a bit of a pretext. So in Guatemala, you have some mega churches, of the biggest churches in the entire world. You know,
are they actually called mega churches?
Called giga churches because they have over 10,000, I think, or 12,000. Okay. And you have a guy called Cash Luna, who's one of the most famous evangelical preacher in Central America.
He fell out with you, didn't he?
Yeah, he fell out with me. Sadly, but Andy,
is that a spoiler? Does that spoil it for me now?
It's been around for a while. The documentary. It's not like it's just come
we
out
can't
today.
Can't watch everything.
Wow!
But then this guy called Pastor Sanchez, and I get told about this village called Almolonga, where God has blessed it with giant carrots.
So like, they are huge, to be fair.
And I was kind of skeptical, you know. And then I got there, and the carrots were legitimately massive, actually huge, like my arm. And then Pastor Sanchez came in the film, and he said anybody who watched the film would be cured of any ailment
that
they may have, like flat feet. He cites as an example. I don't really know anybody who's got flat feet.
I felt great since I watched it, so it's been fine.
What even is flat feet? I think it's a really weird...
When you've got no arch to your feet, yeah.
Out of all the things you'd want to be cured of, I'm sure that
it's kind of debilitating.
Oh, is it really?
An ex-girlfriend of mine had it, and it was kind of... She walks, like, ridiculously
because of flat feet.
No, it's not.
I didn't mean to
I'm not protecting her feelings at all. I'm just saying, it's a thing.
But yeah, and then essentially we find out that, you know, in all likelihood, the carrots probably didn't come from God. He basically takes me on stage. He gives me like a massive bag of giant carrots. And it's really nice. You know, everyone in the town was really happy. He interviewed me for ages. And then we find out that it's probably because the land is quite fertile, they use a lot of fertilizers, pesticides, overuse them potentially.
Oh, so they're actively making big carrots.
Yeah, and it could have health effects essentially. Right. I like to make films first of all that... you know, people don't necessarily know about, because what's the point of making films everyone does know about? Mm. And then secondly, with interesting people, because it's very enjoyable.
You're quite brave, might be the right word, because one of the gang members that you spoke to, and I thought, my God, I couldn't believe you asked the question, when you asked him about how many murdered people, and he was descriptively saying how he'd done this or that, and then I think, what was the question you asked him? Are you a bit of a, did you say?
I called him a psychopath.
Psychopath, that was it.
Well, I said you asking sound a like gang a psychopath. From a psychological perspective, you did actually sound like a psychopath.
Yeah, but I just felt like, as you were saying that in your head, were you thinking, well,
he weirdly didn't get annoyed about that question. He got annoyed when I challenged his manhood.
Here's an interesting thing. I'm going to slightly relate it back to myself, because it's something that I've experienced recently. Do you have, going from that you just reported about, that when you have a camera with you, do you feel like a very different person?
Yeah.
Isn't that really alarming?
Yeah, it's cool though. I like it.
I find it really a lot. I find it really unsettling. I do, honestly. In some of the stuff with the Parapod movie and some of the situations we were in.
Right.
Like, there was one where we were out somewhere remote in the middle of the night and we were just brazenly there. And it was only the next day we thought, we could have just been stabbed there.
Cameras that, like, definitely course, take right. you to,
Yeah, the camera didn't make us safe, but it feels it does.
I wouldn't necessarily say makes you sick. I mean, yeah, it definitely makes you feel slightly... I don't think it makes you feel safer. It just makes me... about 100 times more confident.
Yeah.
I have like an ability to talk to everybody. I feel like I'm a reasonably introverted person in normal life. And then on camera, because I just know that I have to, and you know, it's just my job. I just feel like I'm just suddenly like, oh my god, let's talk to anybody. And also, I'd never want to like do an interview and not ask a difficult question, because you just come across looking really bad, and it's just like, what's the point in talking to somebody if you're not going to actually challenge them? And a camera definitely like kind of makes you do it. Obviously, if I was normally talking to an El Salvadorian gang member, I wouldn't be like, you're a psycho.
I think the camera saved you.
Access all areas on FUBAR Radio.
John Clark's just walked into the studio. I can't concentrate.
You're totally. I was going to say disturbed. That was not the word I meant. Distracted. That's
distracted,
what I meant.
Yeah.
John, hello.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
So most people would know you from TOWIE.
Yeah. Well, Love Island, I'd say.
Well, yes. Well,
Love Island first.
Yes, that's true. Actually,
get it right. Get it right, Stephen.
Don't be TOWIE-ing me off straight away.
So that's two fairly big reality TV shows.
Yeah. Listen, Love Island was the bollocks. Like, I loved Love Island. It was the first one, so everything was not. So how can I say? Like, everything was as real as reality TV can be.
Yeah.
We all got thrown into a villa. No one else knew the show. I ended up getting shacked up with Hannah, and you know, I was there with her for day one, and I ended up coming second, then going on TOWIE, but TOWIE's completely different to Love Island, so...
Because it's scripted reality, isn't it?
Well, scripted reality, you know, there's no scripts involved, but yeah, we are pushed in a certain direction and we keep the storylines, and if you're bringing something to the show, they'll follow it, you know, so, but... I haven't really bought that much to show lately apart from drama, so...
Well, that's kind of
your
vibe.
You do love a little bit of drama, don't you? Because I was saying earlier, I've interviewed your brother, Chris, so I feel like I know the whole family practically now, which is nice. But I was saying to him, I love your bromance.
Yeah.
You two have 100% got each other's back, like me and Stephen, because we're both from the same hometown.
That's true, babe.
Boom.
Somington Massive.
Yes, exactly.
It's down Hampshire. Down on the south coast, yeah.
Hampshire.
Yeah, okay. Have you been there before?
I've been Brighton.
That's Sussex.
Same thing, more or less.
Say no more.
Boom.
Bournemouth, Hampshire.
No, that's Dorset.
It's Dorset. Okay.
It's a fucking geography map, these kids, isn't it?
What did you get in geography at school?
I went to Bournemouth University. That's what I did. Yeah.
What did you get in geography in your GCSE?
I didn't do geography GCSE.
Well, you fucking should have.
I did history. Got a B in history.
Yeah. Oh, I got a C.
Yeah, oh,
what did you get, John?
Oh, I haven't got any GCSEs.
None?
No.
You've got great blagging skills, though.
It's not about what you know, it's about who you know.
I agree with that.
I totally agree with
that. Believe me when I tell you that.
But obviously, yeah, so you were talking... What were we talking about?
I've
completely gone off course.
John's come into the studio and it's all blown up.
You're your brother. So, and obviously, you two have remained tight. There's nothing comes between you, right?
Oh, listen, my brother's my brother. Like, have you got a brother?
Sister.
Yeah, I've got a brother.
So, as being an older brother, I've always looked out for Chris. And obviously, going on Love Island, it was a massive, sick experience for me. Then, obviously, TOWIE come along, and I got the opportunity with TOWIE. It's very family-orientated, and we like to keep it that way, you know? Like, obviously, with the Rights to start with, and then you've got the Brights now.
Oh, yeah, that's
and then
true.
They've now got their own app coming out. So, you know, like, we haven't involved the Clarks too much, because my dad's a bit of a goofy geezer, but my mum's lovely.
Is your mum and dad listening?
I don't know, actually.
Nah, probably watching EastEnders.
I've got a few girls listening, though.
Watching the news. Oh, really?
Yeah, actually, why did I just say that?
Uh-oh.
That was silly. You've got a couple of girls listening.
That was silly. Jesus Christ.
Tell us
I've
more.
Not got any girls listening. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Drop yourself in it now, haven't you, John?
Shizballs.
So you're not on TOWIE anymore.
I'm suspended.
So how's that feel?
It feels normal. I've been suspended a lot in my life, not just from TV.
Right, got it.
So, you know, look, things happen in reality, right? I'm a very heart on your sleeve sort of geek. So I say what I feel when I say it. Sometimes it's not always the best, you know. Sometimes I can do things I shouldn't do. Obviously, me and Dykes had a problem in Newcastle. It was what it was. Me and Dykes are cool now. We're not friends, but we just moved out. We move on from it. Who cares? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just one of those things.
That's a good thing about men, isn't it? Because girls hold a grudge.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, with men are like, cool, let's get a Nando's and we're done.
Well, I wouldn't get Nando's with him, but, you know, I'd order him one to his ass.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll pay for it.
I'll pay for it. I'll meet him halfway.
But as long as he doesn't have to eat it with you.
No.
Got it. Got it.
So the intent's there. Good gestures there.
But that's fine. And you know, not everyone you work with, you're always going to get on well with.
Of course not. But I'm taking some time at the moment. I'm going to slip over to a boot camp. I'm going to do a month in a boot camp because I quit smoking 4 months, guys, and I'm 15 stone 4.
Well done. Wow. That's good, though.
Yeah, I know, but I'm fat.
So you gained a bit of weight because
yeah, a little bit. I'm 15 stone 4. I'm every geezer, mate. I'm every set.
That's like Stephen. He's going to give up drinking.
I'm giving up drinking next year. Yeah.
Well, you becoming a Jehovah's Witness?
No, I just want some focus in my life, so yeah.
Are you a heavy drinker? Do we have a problem? Hi, my name's Stephen, and I've been drinking every day for the last 7 years.
Yeah. That's something we need to talk
about. You
want
to be open? I can already see a glass of wine on the table, mate. If you're a wino, you're a wino. It doesn't matter.
This is something that I was actually talking about earlier.
Cheers to that,
Steve.
Yeah,
you got gin and tonic. What are you talking about?
Look at you, Steve.
I've got a lemonade, bro. Whatever. Don't be silly.
No, but you know, sometimes you need to do something in your life to make a solid change, right? So you've given up smoking, and maybe that's meant you put on a bit of weight, but you want to get that off.
Yeah, but the thing is, with smoking, obviously smoking's bad for you. We all know that. Weight I can get off. So now what I'm doing is I'm going to focus on myself. I'm going to hit the boot camp, smash that out, and the next year I'm going to come back looking better than ever.
Okay.
And I do think there probably will be a bit of another shake up on Towie, because there always is.
Yeah.
I think it needs a shake up. I think we'll all say it needs a bit of a shake up.
I don't disagree with you.
Especially being with seeing old Samson, you know. Yeah. I was a bit starstruck. The geezer don't understand. Listen, I love that album.
He's a legend.
Absolutely Ascot. What a blinding programme, eh? I wish I could be on that.
Well, maybe you could.
We can make that happen for you, John.
Joey Page on FUBAR Radio.
Jonathan from Everything Everything, welcome to the show, sir.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Yeah, really great. So excited about having you on. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, mate.
How did you get your stage look together?
We've got this guy called William Green who makes our clothes each time we make an album, basically. And he's a designer. He's got loads of ideas. And we basically come to him with kind of where we're heading and kind of want to look a bit like this or this. And he basically draws up loads of stuff. And usually it's the first thing he does. We're like, yeah, that's brilliant. We'll do that for the next 2 years. He makes it and then we wear it.
I mean, you've probably got to be, I would say, and I'm being a bit fangirly about this, so sorry. You've probably got to be, at the moment, one of the most verbose, intellectual, kind of popular, newish kind of bands at the moment. And it's really cool, like, to see somebody doing something so different. Did you ever get a bit scared that would kind of hinder you?
Yeah, we definitely did. Thanks very much, by the way. We're always wondering whether people accept us or get us at all, really. When you listen to the radio, we've just been doing it actually just now. We've had the radio on, and there's a lot of stuff that's nothing like us on there. We're kind of placed into this pop world, and sometimes we don't know how we got here, but we're really grateful for it. It's really nice to be successful in any way. But it's especially nice to be amongst loads of stuff that isn't really like you.
Yeah, well, it must be nice to be successful by not really compromising in what you do. Do you know what I mean? So I imagine it would be quite easy to go, oh, you could write something really simple and easy and hope that makes you some money.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's always the kind of ghost on our shoulder kind of going, well, you guys, you could do this. You probably have a number one. And we're like, we know that's always there. We haven't bent to it yet. And it wouldn't make us very happy, I think, if we did do that. But it's never far away. It's always a kind of thing that you see other bands doing and you wonder what that would be like and how you'd feel about it. Stuff
sure.
like that. But so far, we've not done it, which is we're all really proud of.
Hugh Joseph on FUBAR Radio.
All right, well, we're backstage now, Love Box, with very good young old mate of ours, Zach Abel. How are you doing, sir?
Oh, I feel young and old at the same time, so slightly confused.
Well, that can happen when you're young old age, I guess. Things like that happen.
At the young old age of 21, I'm here today with man like Hugh.
You just come off stage, off the noisy stage. You really fucking smashed that, my brother. How are you feeling after that?
I feel good. Good vibes on stage and good vibes from the audience. So,
one thing I did notice from your performance, do you feel like threatened a little bit at all by, I don't know if you were seeing some of the eyes that the older women were giving you, but did you feel potentially, like, for me, I saw that and I was like, he needs to fucking watch his back. He needs to watch his back badly. Were you getting that vibe from up there?
There was a connection between me and older ladies.
There was a couple of babes way, way above your age, Zach, that were thinking impure thoughts. There is absolutely no doubt about that. Impure thoughts.
I'd be lying if I said I didn't have a few impure thoughts of my own towards those older ladies as well. Yeah, I think age is just a number.
Great. So that leads me to my next question. Thank you very much, Zach Abel. What's the oldest woman you think you'd potentially want to sleep with?
At this point in my life right now, I mean, I don't have preferences, man. I just think, yeah.
I'll get you started, right? I'm in my 30s. I think, sure, you know, why not? I'd pump a hot 60-year-old. Why not?
Yeah. I mean, my friend, who is 35, his girlfriend is 65. and it works between them.
Is that serious? Are you being serious?
Being deadly serious. They are an amazing couple, both lovely people, and so it can be done. So I could be with a 51-year-old now, and it would be cool, technically.
All you 51-year-old babes out there, just be aware, next time, front row at a Zach Abel concert, you might actually get, you never know. Hey, anyway, so obviously the last song of your set, Everybody Needs Love, that was a pretty good response. You must be pretty happy. You're very good at conducting the stage and getting everybody involved, the back and forth. How do you feel like after seeing your single, a lot of people singing it, and it's obviously a pretty amazing reception?
It feels amazing. I mean, the song is about how we all need love, whether we're up or down, and it was a song that I wrote for myself and for everyone, really, and I felt like that was everyone coming together, singing it together, so it's good vibes, yeah. Unity.
We definitely need love now more than ever. Also, I did notice as well, I was in Superdrug recently, and I was buying earbuds, deodorant, stuff like that, and then I heard Zach Abel's voice, come on a Superdrug. How do you feel about them changing your single to Everybody Needs Superdrug? Everybody needs super drug.
You say that, but there is a parody version that me and my guy at my record label have, which is sometimes we get silly and say everybody needs drugs. But we're, of course, joking.
Oh, right.
We are, of course, joking.
Yeah, because otherwise it's everybody needs hugs.
Everyone needs hugs, as drugs are illegal.
Are you enjoying the band? How's it going with the band? They're pretty amazing players, man. That's incredible.
I'm very, very lucky to have them. They're awesome. 100%.
Good chat.
Super tight. I met my keys player because he played on These Are the Days originally. He came out with a mid-late part in that. And then from there, he knew a guy who then became the drummer. And then he knew a guy who became the drummer when he wasn't around. And so we've kind of just kept it on like a referral thing. And so everyone's kind of in the same family. So I'm lucky in that respect. And the guitarist, Leon, used to play guitar for the late Amy Winehouse. So, you know, I'm with good company.
Definitely in safe hands. Are they helping you with any writing? Are you in the studio with these the guys you're recording with, or what's happening there?
Yeah, we've done a couple of writing sessions. I was in with Leon actually a couple of days ago, and we're writing as well. So, yeah, why not?
So, what are you working? Can you tell us anything you're working on?
There's one name that I'm working with at the moment called I Love Electric, but know me, I'm probably just going to change it about four times before it actually comes out.
What electric things do you love? Because there's a lot. Like when I first think of what comes to mind electric, I think electric toothbrush, maybe electric blender, electric dildos. There's so many things. What's your favorite electric thing, Zach Abel?
I just think all of the ones you said there, that they're all brilliant things to think about. I'm thinking about it right now, Probably because you just said it. But I think electricity has been a huge part of my life. Electricity is amazing. When they made the light bulb, I know it changed a lot of people's lives, and so that's a huge thing for me. Appreciation.
Who was it that invented electricity? Was it Thomas Newton or something like that?
Yeah, Edison. Thomas something. Yeah. Thank you, Thomas.
Thomas Edison. Thank you so much for inventing electricity, because it's inspired Zach Abel. Do you feel like this is going to shine a light on a lot of things for you?
Wow. You heard it first. Mr. Q. Shine a light.
I'm just a bit...
That was good. That was good. It's like dad gag, but plus seven. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm into the dad gags.
Well, I could be a dad. You don't know.
Are you a dad?
I don't know either. Who knows? Could be.
That's a beautiful thought. That's cool.
Hey, do you like performing at festivals? Or did you prefer more intimate shows or like a venue? Or what's the vibe?
I like both, really. I think I prefer intimate ones. Because you don't have to do as many like covers, I suppose, because people are there for you, and like if it's like a headline show, then they've come specifically to see you, so you can get a bit more creative with the stuff you play. You don't have to tailor it for people who don't know who you are as such.
How do you feel like you would do that for a festival like Lovebox if you want to tailor it more to a broader crowd?
I think I found like with the festivals, people like more up-tempo stuff. So for festivals, I normally do more up-tempo songs in the set.
Okay, all right, cool. Well, thank you so much. You're amazing, guy. It's lovely to see you again. And it was an incredible set, so congratulations.
Harriet Rose on FUBAR Radio.
I'm joined by Zara Larsson, looking absolutely outstanding.
Thanks.
Maleficent, am I right?
So do you.
No, not as good as you. Can you wiggle your horns? Because I keep seeing you do that and it looks too cool. That is incredible.
I don't really know how this is going to
It's like the most mesmerizing.
I'm dancing when I'm performing.
But it's the most mesmerizing wiggle I've ever seen. Because you've had a busy week, haven't you? You've been doing a lot of Halloween-y stuff.
Absolutely.
So have we got anything extra special to look forward to other than the horn wiggle?
I don't really know.
Do you have a lot of fun when you play in the UK?
I do. I really do. You One of it. My favorite memories from today's, I mean, this year's summer was V.
So sick. Yeah. I was there. You were fantastic.
Yeah, it was fun.
The energy is out of this world. Now, is there anything spooky or scary or frightening that's ever happened to you on stage?
No.
Maybe you'll see a ghost.
Maybe I'll see a ghost. I'll tell you if I do.
Have you seen a ghost before in your life?
No. I used to, like, really, really, I wanted to believe in them so bad when I was little. I do Ouija board all the time.
Ouija? That's
all the time.
Stay home and chill, keeping you company during the coronavirus.